CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including social networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. And with ZipRecruiter's premium traffic boost, you can get up to 3 times more candidates. Quickly screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. Right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. Plus, get 30% off your first traffic boost by going to ZipRecruiter.com/deal. That's ZipRecruiter.com/deal. One more time. To try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/deal.
I'm Bob Schieffer. Today on Face the Nation, the Secretary of State, the rookie senator, and nuclear negotiations with Iran. As Secretary of State Kerry headed into the home stretch of negotiations to limit Iran's nuclear capabilities, freshman Senator Tom Cotton sent the Iranians a letter signed by 47 Republicans warning them any agreement could prove worthless. Has that derailed the talks? Secretary of State Kerry tells our Margaret Brennan he's not sure.
So how do you clear the air? Are you going to apologize for this letter?
Not on your life. I'm not going to apologize for the for an unconstitutional, unthought-out action by somebody who's been in the United States Senate for 60-some days.
We'll hear more from Kerry and Cotton's explanation of why he did it. Plus, Democratic Senator Joe Manchin and Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings on that and the week's other news. Plus a report on the state of race relations in America. Because this is Face the Nation. Good morning. We begin with Margaret Brennan's interview with Secretary Kerry as he prepared to leave Egypt and fly to Switzerland for the talks. She asked him flatly, had the Cotton letter put the talks in jeopardy?
Well, I don't know yet. Negotiate for the first time on Sunday night with Foreign Minister Zarif, I'll have a better sense of where we are. But what I do know is that this letter was absolutely calculated directly to interfere with these negotiations. It specifically inserts itself directly to the leader of another country saying, don't negotiate with these guys because we're going to change this, which, by the way, is not only contrary to the Constitution with respect to the executive's right to negotiate, but it is incorrect because they cannot change an executive agreement. So it's false information and directly calculated to interfere and basically say, don't negotiate with them. You got to negotiate with 535 members of Congress.
But they
That's unprecedented.
And unprecedented. They have to negotiate with you. You're the one who has to sit at that table.
Well, I understand, but it's unprecedented. I've never seen anything like this. Now, in fairness, look, I don't know how many people really focus completely on it, but I do know that the effect and the intent of the author was to basically say, don't do this deal. And by the way, that's to say that before there even is a deal. I mean, it's like, giving people a grade on a test before the test is even written, let alone given. It's wrong, it's unprecedented, and I hope it hasn't made it very difficult here. And by the way, this is not just the United States of America negotiating. This is China, Russia, Germany, France, Great Britain.
So how do you clear the air? Are you going to apologize for this letter?
Not on your life. I'm not going to apologize for the for an unconstitutional and unthought-out action by somebody who's been in the United States Senate for 60-some days. That's just inappropriate. I will explain very clearly that Congress does not have the right to change an executive agreement. Another president may have a different view about it, but if we do our job correctly, all of these nations, they all have an interest in making sure this is in fact a proven peaceful program. And it would be derelict if we allow some gaping hole in this program that doesn't do so. But you know, let's see what it is first. And I think this applies to everybody, incidentally, who's been trying to judge this before, in fact, the deal, if it can be sealed, is sealed.
You've made the point this is an international agreement. This isn't just the U.S. and Iran. But Senator Corker, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, said the decision to bypass Congress and instead go to the U.N. and allow them to vote on some of this deal is a direct affront to the American people.
Well, with all due respect, look, I do really disagree with that judgment, and I talked to him about it the other day and made it clear. We are negotiating under the auspices, to some degree, of the United Nations. So just as Congress has to vote to lift sanctions, so Congress does have a vote, so does the United Nations have to lift some sanctions at some point in time.
Well, that's on sanctions, but to authorize this deal, do you see Congress having a role?
Congress has a role. We have had over 205 briefings, phone calls, discussions with Congress. 119 of them have taken place since January of this year. We have been in full discussion with Congress on this. We've been in full discussion with allies in the region. We have had our team go to Israel or meet with Israelis in Washington or elsewhere to brief them regularly in this process. This isn't, a complete mystery. And the fact is that But we also have been operating under a rule that everybody understands. Nothing is agreed to until everything is agreed to. And so we have to finish our negotiation, and we deserve the right to do so, frankly, knowing we have to submit it to the world to judge. We ought to be able to find out unimpeded and uninterfered with in an unconstitutional way, in violation of 200-plus years of tradition.
The president wants a deal by the end of March. If you can't meet that timetable, what happens?
Margaret, we are trying to get a deal by the end of March.
Would there be an extension?
Well, the president's view, and I share this view completely, is that we've been at this for over 2 years now, and Iran has said its program is peaceful. In the time that we've had, the fundamental framework of decisions necessary to prove your program is peaceful should be possible. So we believe very much that there's not anything that's going to change in April or May or June that suggests that at that time a decision you can't make now will be made then. If it's peaceful, let's get it done. And my hope is that in the next days that will be possible.
But if these talks fail, do you think there is a risk that Iran will make the choice to build a bomb?
Of course there's that risk, obviously.
Is that really what's at stake?
Well, look, if they moved along the road to decide suddenly to break out and rush to try to have enough fissile material to build a bomb, we have a number of options available to us. President Obama has said they are all on the table, and he has also pledged very publicly and very clearly on a number of occasions, Iran will not be allowed to get a nuclear weapon.
Secretary Kerry also addressed the situation in Syria. We'll have that in our next half hour. But now we are joined by Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who wrote that letter. You heard what the secretary said: unprecedented, inappropriate, unthought out, unconstitutionally wrong. What were you trying to accomplish, Senator?
Bob, I and 46 other senators are focused on stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, and we wanted to be crystal clear that Iran's leaders got the message that in our constitutional system, while the president negotiates deals, Congress has to approve them for them to be lasting and binding. And I have to say, I'm surprised by Secretary's comments this morning, because just a few days ago, he testified before the Senate to say that any deal would not be legally binding. And now he says that future Congresses can't change a mere executive agreement if we disagree with them or if a future president disagrees with them. That's not the way our constitutional system works, and it's certainly not the way we should be negotiating with Iran.
Did you talk to the Secretary of State? Did you talk to any Democrats in the Senate before you chose to go directly to the Iranians?
I and many other senators, Republican and Democrat, have expressed our sincere and long-held intent that Congress must approve any nuclear deal with Iran. for months. In fact, going back almost 2 years ago, I was part of a 400-person majority in the House of Representatives that sought to impose more sanctions on Iran. We did reach out to some Democratic offices, but I can tell you that the viewpoint is widely shared, and I don't see how anyone could dispute that if a deal is reached with Iran that is not approved by the Congress, then future Congresses and future presidents don't have to accept it in our constitutional system.
Well, Senator, it's not exactly news to say that that the Congress can pass laws to change whatever laws or agreements are on the books. But why did you decide to try to convince the Iranians that they needed to be wary of dealing with the United States? Why not take your argument to the American people? Why didn't you write an open letter in the New York Times or something?
Iran's leaders needed to hear the message loud and clear. I can tell you they are not hearing that message from Geneva. In fact, if you look at the response of the Iranian foreign minister, Javad Zarif, it underscores the need for the letter in the first place because he made it clear that he does not understand our constitutional system. He thinks that international law can override our Constitution.
Well, Senator, are you planning to contact any other of our adversaries around the country? For example, do you plan to check with the North Koreans to make sure that they know that any deal has to be approved by the Congress?
Bob, right now I and most every other senator is focused on stopping Iran from getting a nuclear weapon. And that's why it's so important that we communicated this message straight to Iran, because they're not hearing it from Geneva. And remember, this is not a parliamentary democracy. The Islamic Revolution of Iran has been killing Americans, hundreds of Americans, for 35 years in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Saudi Arabia. Well, they kill Jews around the world, from Israel to Bulgaria to Argentina.
How does it make America stronger to tell them that any agreement they make with this administration may not be worth the paper it's written on and may not last beyond this presidency? How does that make things better?
It's a simple fact of our Constitution that if Congress doesn't approve that deal, then it may not last. And the deal that is on the table right now is a very bad deal. It would allow Iran to have thousands and thousands of centrifuges to continue enriching uranium. It would do nothing to the military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. It's excluded entirely the ballistic missile program that Iran has, which is designed solely to strike the United States right here at home, and it could have a 10-year sunset. Bob, since you brought up North Korea, I would point out that in 1994, the United States entered into something called the Agreed Framework to stop North Korea from getting a bomb. They almost immediately started cheating on it, and a mere 12 years later, they detonated their first nuclear weapon. Now the world has to live with the consequences of a nuclear North Korea. I don't want the world to live with the consequences of a nuclear Iran.
Earlier today, former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright told our local affiliate here, WUSA, that what you did was akin to during the Cuban Missile Crisis. If a senator had called Nikita Khrushchev and told him he couldn't be certain that President Kennedy could back up any deal he made with him, do you see a comparison there?
No, I would disagree. And Secretary Albright was part of the Clinton administration that entered into the fundamentally flawed agreement for work with North Korea. But more fundamentally, what we did was to send a clear message to a dictatorial regime. We didn't coddle or conciliate with the dictators in Iran. We told them that the American people, 71% of the American people in a recent poll, will not accept a deal that puts Iran on the path to a nuclear weapon. 71% of the American people are right, and that's for whom we're speaking.
What do you want to happen here? What is your alternative here? Let's say that the deal falls through. Then what?
Well, as Prime Minister Netanyahu said, the alternative to a bad deal is a better deal. The Iranians frequently bluff to walk away from the table. If they bluff this week, call their bluff. The Congress stands ready to impose much more severe sanctions. Moreover, we have to stand up to Iran's attempts to drive for regional dominance. They already control Tehran. Increasingly, they control Damascus and Beirut and Baghdad and now Sana'a as well. They do all that without a nuclear weapon. Imagine what they would do with a nuclear weapon.
I just want to make sure, do you feel that you have not weakened the president's hand here? And do you have any regrets about the way you went about this?
No regrets at all. And if the president and the Secretary of State were intent on driving a hard bargain, they would be able to point to this letter and say, they're right, as Secretary Kerry said on Wednesday in a Senate testimony, any lasting deal needs to be approved by Congress. When past senators like Joe Biden or Jesse Helms communicated directly with foreign leaders, past presidents like Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton did just that. The fact But the fact that President Obama doesn't see this letter as a way to get more leverage at the negotiating table just underscores that he is not negotiating for the hardest deal possible. He is negotiating a deal that is going to put Iran on the path to a bomb.
All right.
If not today or tomorrow, then 10 years from now.
We'll stop there, Senator. Thank you for coming by and explaining your point.
Thank you.
We're going to go now to a Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, who serves on the Armed Services Committee. He joins us from Charleston, West Virginia. Senator, did you have any contact or discuss any of this with Senator Cotton before he took this action?
I did not. And no one from my staff came and said that anyone had approached them. And, you know, if this was going to be a sense of the Senate, Bob, you would think it would try to be as bipartisan as possible to see if that's a direction we feel strongly about. And maybe we could have helped negate this from happening. I think it was wrong. I would not have signed it, but I was not approached.
The White House Chief of Staff, Dennis McDonough, has written the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Bob Corker, and asked him this morning to hold off on any legislation on Iran or this deal on the issue of whether or not a nuclear deal can be reached until at least June. Does that sound right to you? Because I know that Senator Tim Kaine says that probably you can't wait that long, and he's the Democrat. He wants Congress to vote on this.
Well, let me just say this, that Democrats and Republicans alike are committed not to allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. It's just, I guess, the approach of how we go about it. We've got to speak with one voice. Now, we can speak within the process that we have and let the White House and the State Department know how strongly we feel about something, against it, or for it. Perfect example, Bob, was back when the State Department came over and tried to explain to us why they wanted to start bombing Syria, if you recall that not that long ago, a year or two ago. I, as a Democrat, spoke out loudly against that. I thought all it did was light the fuse for the Third World War. And basically all of us, Democrats and Republicans, who felt strongly that we shouldn't drop the bomb, we were able to succeed, and the president was able to negotiate with Russia to remove the chemical weapons. That did not take an approval of Congress, but we were heard. This same process should be used now. And what we need to do, I signed a letter with Bob Menendez and other senators basically saying, let's see how far you've progressed on the end of March, if we have a deal in the making, and then at the end of June, if we don't have a deal at hand, we will double down on sanctions. But we're still allowing the White House and the State Department to do their job.
Do you think this action by Senator Cotton and this letter has poisoned the well?
It sure hasn't helped a thing. It hasn't helped one thing except drive us further apart. You know, the country is divided enough. We need to start bringing us together. And for, like you said, over 200 years, we've operated under a process that basically we've had the executive branch, the State Department, the executive branch, working and speaking as one, but speaking through and with us being able to have input from the legislative branch. I believe that has worked very well. I believe it still can. But we could second guess all day long and get nothing accomplished. There's five other countries, as Secretary Kerry had said. It's not just the United States of America. And if you want sanctions to work, it's got to be a bigger part of NATO, a bigger part of the world, doubling down and saying, listen, you're not part of the civilized world. Either get your act together or we will make it more difficult for you.
With CUDA Sign, paperless e-signing is a no-brainer for any business that requires legally binding signatures fast. That's because CUDA Sign offers everything you should expect from an electronic signature solution for just $1 per month. CUDA Sign cuts document turnaround time as much as 90%, thanks in part to its number one rated mobile app. And CUDA Sign's secure cloud stores documents for on-demand tracking and retrieval, saving you even more time and money. Don't think twice. Get CUDA Sign now for just $1 per month. Go to CUDASign.com.
And we're back now with Congressman Elijah Cummings, who is not only the top Democrat on the Benghazi Investigating Committee, but the top Democrat on the Oversight Committee investigating the seemingly endless problems that the Secret Service is having. Another week here, Congressman, where we just kind of had an overload on news and most of it bad news. I am dismayed and perplexed about what the Secret Service is going through. I mean, it seems like ever since they took them out from under the Treasury Department and put them in under the Homeland Security Agency, that it's just been one thing after another. Are you satisfied with what you have found out about this latest incident so far, and what needs to be done here?
I am extremely upset about it.
And it's extremely frustrating, Bob, to see an agency that is supposed to be the number one elite protective agency in the world, protecting the most important person in the world, the most powerful person in the world, to operate like this. Director Clancy has come in, and he has made many, many changes. As a matter of fact, he's now gotten rid of the half of the top folks in the agency. But clearly, this latest incident shows that we've still got a lot of work to be done. And, Bob, you know, there's a culture of complacency and mediocrity taking place. And so we're going to have to do a deep dive. And one thing I am glad about is that Republicans and Democrats agree on this, that we've got to put a high-powered microscope on this agency and address some of these issues.
Do you now have confidence? Does Director Clancy still retain your confidence?
He does. He's only been there for a few months, Bob. He's, again, I'm very impressed with the things that he's done already. But now I think he's going to have to begin to get rid of even more people. There are certain people that should not be there. And you cannot have supervisors telling the rank and file that they can't do their job, such as when they wanted the other night to perform a sobriety test. Give me a break.
Let's talk a little bit about the other big story of the week, and that is the Hillary Clinton emails. Clearly, I mean, if you cut to the chase, basically what was going on here, it seems to me, is that Hillary Clinton did not want to leave a paper trail. And so she set up these various procedures and so forth. Do you think she is the best judge of what ought to be made public and what, you know, what ought to be part of the government record?
Well, Bob, every federal employee under federal regs has the responsibility to determine what's personal and what's official. She made that judgment. I listened to her carefully, and I believe her. But, Bob, if we have issues with Hillary Clinton, we have to keep in mind, number one, she's been extremely cooperative with our committee. She agreed to come in as early as last December. And so she's willing to come in under oath and testify as to the emails, how she selected the one she did. And we ought to have her come in, not only to testify about the emails, but also to testify about Benghazi. By the way, just last Friday, her lawyers contacted Trey Gowdy, the chairman, and yours truly, and urged us to release the 850 pages of emails that we now have. And hopefully Trey will agree to that and we'll make that happen.
Well, are you satisfied that there's anything else to find out about Benghazi?
I don't know. We've been at this now, Bob, since May. And I still don't know the scope of what we're looking for. I think there have been 8 investigations. They've been done extremely well. And I think they've resolved most of the questions.
All right. Mr. Cummings, we certainly thank you for coming to see us. In a time when real leadership is such a rare commodity, I want to recognize the decisive action of Oklahoma University President David Boren. I knew David Boren when he was a U.S. Senator. He was a good one, and since joining the university, he has been a strong leader in higher education. When that nauseating video of OU fraternity boys singing racist songs showed up on the internet, Boren had all kinds of options: open an investigation, confer with his trustees, maybe convene a focus group. But he moved with such speed, I doubt he did any of that. He simply expelled those involved and threw the fraternity off campus. No ifs, ands, and buts, he said. You are out of here, and don't let the screen door hit you on the way out. I'm not surprised in our litigious society that the fraternity has now hired a lawyer who may sue unless Boren reconsiders and joins in making this a teachable moment. I think what's teachable is pretty obvious. Actions have consequences, and hateful words are dangerous things, sometimes as harmful to those who deliver them as those they are aimed at. If the students didn't know that before, well, now they do.
For the best from CBS Radio News whenever you want it, download our podcasts at cbsnews.com/podcasts.
Welcome back now to Face the Nation. We're going to pick up where we left off with a discussion of the racist videos that came out of a University of Oklahoma fraternity. This week, protests that continued in Madison, Wisconsin, where an unarmed black teenager was shot and killed by police last weekend, and in Ferguson, where two police officers were seriously wounded while managing protesters following the resignation of the police chief, which came after the Justice Department's damning report of racial bias there. And joining us now, Sherrilyn Ifill, the president of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund and the president of the NAACP, Cornell William Brooks. Thank you all so much for coming. You know, this is actually the anniversary, the actual date, when President Johnson made the famous We Shall Overcome speech. And then it was 5 months after that, of course, that the Voting Rights Act was passed. We had all these wonderful demonstrations last week down in Selma. President was down there. And yet, all of these horrible things have happened this week. Mr. Brooks, how would you judge the state of race relations in America today, 50 years after that speech?
Certainly. We as a nation seem to be uncomfortably poised between our past and the present. It was my privilege to walk in Selma behind the president, between the president and Amelia Boynton, who 50 years ago was beaten down. She's 105 years now. The point being here is that much of the country, particularly some of our young people, don't seem to understand or remember or be aware of the history and what so many people had to go through in order for them to enjoy the rights they have today. Because if they understood, you would not be able to sing about lynching. 5,000 or so people were lynched in this country. So to have members of a fraternity sing about lynching in a cavalier way and associate lynching with exclusive policies with respect to membership, absolutely shocking.
Sherrilyn, what is your take? You know, some of the residents who were interviewed in Ferguson this week said they didn't understand why people were still protesting down there. After all, I mean, they'd gotten rid of half the police force and the people there. Why do you think those demonstrations go on?
Well, in many ways, I think they have to go on because the work is not complete. In fact, we're at the moment where the work really has to push forward, and that is that the Department of Justice now is entering into negotiations with the leaders of Ferguson about how they're going to change that police department. And I think this is the time when the protests actually have to become more focused and more targeted in terms of thinking about what is the result that you want. Elections are next month in Ferguson, and you've got city council elections and African Americans running for city council seats at numbers they never did in the past. So there's a real opportunity for change, and I think the people who are out want to make sure that that change actually happens. There's a lot of work to be done, and I think this discomfort that we're all feeling, actually, even though it feels like we're going backwards, that's actually when we go forwards. It's just like, you know, in Selma, it's just like on that Edmund Pettus Bridge. It's these moments of confrontation when we actually get to see what is really happening in America, whether it's that video that shocks us all and that's so repugnant. The most dangerous times for race in America is when we're papering over what the reality is.
Well, you know, things have been pretty quiet here in recent years. But then all of a sudden we have, you know, these police incidents in Ferguson, then in New York, now up in Wisconsin. Is this just coincidence, Mr. Brooks, or is there a connection here?
I don't believe it's a coincidence. I believe we're in a particular moment, if you will, a third reconstruction. We are at a point in American history where we can move forward or we can move backward. We have made tremendous progress in terms of voting rights, but we've seen tremendous challenges in terms of criminal justice reform and a backward movement with respect to voting rights. So we're at a moment where we need to catalyze these disparate protests around the country into a real movement for reform. In Ferguson, we have a handful of bills in the state legislature that would make a tremendous difference in terms of civilian review boards. We have in Congress a Voting Rights Act amendment that needs to be tweaked, needs to be improved, but we need to move forward on that because we're at a point where this country has to move forward, and you have a generation of young people who get it. They think we can do better, and I believe we can do better. And in fact, we need a Congress that is as engaged, as committed to our highest democratic and constitutional values as these young people on the streets.
Well, I actually don't think it's been quiet. I think actually in communities all over this country, African-American communities, this is what people have been rolling against. And it's only that it's come to national consciousness, largely because of cell phone videos and other ways in which we've been able to see what people have been saying for years. So that's what's created the moment, the fact that it has now risen to national consciousness. And that's a good thing. There are things that can be done. We've got an End Racial Profiling Act that has been languishing in Congress for years that Congress needs to act on. Cornell just talked about the various bills that are in the Ferguson legislature. And we're also seeing a crisis of Democratic governance. You know, the democratic structure of Ferguson is very much like the democratic structure of communities all over this country, with the part-time mayor that gets $350 a month and the part-time city council and the town manager who really has all the power. It's an opportunity for us to really look at representative government and to make real change. And that's the moment that Cornell's talking about. So rather than just sit with the discomfort, we really have to begin to dig in and work on change.
And Bob, I'll just note this, that the NAACP has launched what we call America's Journey for Justice, a series of demonstrations, direct actions from Selma, Alabama, across Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, and into D.C. Why? Because we're trying to take advantage of this democratic upsurge in this country based upon real problems. When we think about the fact on the Voting Rights Act, 11% of the electorate doesn't have an ID, 25% of African Americans, and yet we see this frenzy of voter disenfranchisement all across the country. People are responding to real problems. When it comes to the criminal justice front, we've seen massive racial profiling. And so the point being here is we have people in this country who sense what is wrong, and they also sense what can be made right. And they know that Congress can act, but has failed to do so.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for bringing this to our attention on this really what is an historic day. Thank you so much. Now with our panel joining us this week, Susan Page, who is USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief, the New York Times White House correspondent Peter Baker, plus Bloomberg Politics Managing Editor John Heilemann, and Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank. Well, you heard the man of the hour here in Washington, Senator Tom Cotton, this 60 days in the United States Senate, and now he's at the top of every story. What did you make of this morning, Susan?
Well, he certainly didn't back off in response to your questions, including about whether he was next going to try to send a letter to the leaders of North Korea. You know, what's surprising to me is not that Tom Cotton would choose to write a letter like this. What's surprising to me is the most senior Republicans in the Senate, including the Senate Majority Leader, would sign such a letter. That is, as with the Netanyahu speech to a joint session of Congress, really the kind of steps we have not seen taken before in modern times.
Peter, what do you think Senator Cotton's, what was his objective here, to derail these talks?
I think in some ways, yes. I do think he feels strongly, and a lot of people in the Congress and both parties actually feel strongly, that these talks are not leading to a deal that they feel they can support. His North Korea example as a precedent is actually a reasonable one to look at. Did that show that inspectors can do what we're asking inspectors to do this time around? What's interesting about it, though, is that it seems to jeopardize what had been a bipartisan skepticism. There are quite a number of Democrats who had signed on to legislation intended to force President Obama to come to them, and now they're kind of upset about this. They did not sign this letter, and it's actually, the White House actually is kind of happy, frankly, that it played out this way.
Right. Now, clearly, Cotton has no regrets, but some of his fellow signatories are beginning to. We had John McCain this week blaming the weather, saying it was a snowstorm and we were rushing out of town and I didn't read the fine print. And I think they're realizing, yes, Cotton is well-intentioned in doing this, but it's backfiring. You know, and if the Ayatollah is going to give out his Ayatollah's Medal of Honor this year, I think Cotton's going to be a finalist because it gives them an excuse if they pull away from the agreement now, and the rest of the world's going to say, oh, well, it's the Senate of the United States' fault, making it more likely they're wrong.
I was a little surprised. Here is a guy who is an Iraqi in Afghanistan, a veteran. He was in the military. He has an exemplary record. I just found the whole thing sort of surprising, John.
Well, you see some freshman senators who arrive in town and want to get on the map pretty quickly, and that seems to have been part of, it seems you've kind of sensed that that's part of his motivation. I think fascinating this week, listening to former foreign policy people from past Bush administrations, people like Richard Haass, this morning Michael Gerson, saying this is a huge mistake, and partly because of the thing that Dana's related to, referring to, which is that if these talks fall apart, you want to be in a position to blame Iran for the talks falling apart. Now there is a plausible counter-narrative if the talks fall apart, that it's a dissension on the U.S. side. And secondly, if they do fall apart, you're going to want to put back together and up and ratchet up the sanctions regime. And that requires huge international cooperation, and this makes it harder. So in the worst-case scenario, that could be the biggest effect here. No, we get no deal, but it's harder then to keep pressure on Iran going forward.
One of the things that Secretary Kerry also talked about in addition to this when he talked to our Margaret Brennan last night was Syria and the whole situation there. And I want to just play a portion of what he said on that.
We are working very hard with other interested parties to see if we can reignite a diplomatic outcome. Why? Because everybody agrees there is no military solution. There is only a political solution. But to get the Assad regime to negotiate, we're going to have to make it clear to him that there is a determination by everybody to seek that political outcome and change his calculation about negotiating. That's underway right now. And I am convinced that with the efforts of our allies and others, there will be increased pressure on Assad.
And you'd be willing to negotiate with him?
Well, we have to negotiate in the end.
So there you hear the Secretary of State saying we may have to negotiate with Assad. Is that a change in the administration's position?
Well, it is in a way, because the condition has always been through all of these negotiations that have taken place in the past on Syria with the Russians and others, was that Assad had to go and that he could not be a part of these conversations because, you know, except to negotiate his own withdrawal, in effect. So there is an implication in what Secretary Kerry just said that Assad might, in fact, have room to remain in power in some sort of future talks.
It's probably not terribly helpful, what Secretary Kerry just said, because it may be true as a matter that you have to negotiate a political solution, but they're trying to get an authorization for the use of force through the Congress now. So you can imagine Senator Cotton hearing that and pulling out his quill pen and dashing off another letter now to Assad and saying, watch out, man.
I'm going to make a prediction. I'm going to predict that he doesn't do that.
But, not after your questioning of it.
But he might do that. Let's talk about the other huge story of the week, and that is the Hillary Clinton email saga. What's going on here?
Well, I guess I think there's no voter who was on the fence about Hillary Clinton, and there, in fact, maybe no voter who's on the fence about Hillary Clinton. But if there were one, I don't think the idea that she had her own server and her private email address as Secretary of State would sway anybody. But it does make us feel like, welcome to the new Clinton campaign, just like the old Clinton campaign, where we're going to have these kind of pitch battles, scandals, privacy, control. And that is, I think, not good news for Hillary Clinton, who really needs to be talking about the future. What is her vision? What would she do about income inequality? What would she do about Syria? I think it's probably kind of disheartening for those of us who are going to spend the next 2 years of our lives covering this campaign.
You know, her husband famously says that's what campaigns are about. The campaigns are about the future and not the past. For a 67-year-old woman who has had the history she's had, and she has had an incredible history in American politics, for her to be demonstrating all of the kinds of traits that people associate with the worst aspects, yes, of the Clintons. There are many great aspects about the Clintons that people in America love, but there's other aspects about them people are uneasy with, and in particular, the notion that they play by their own rules. And that came through seeing that spectacle, seeing that press conference. All of that just revives memories that make, for people who have some unease about the Clintons, it revives all those memories, and it certainly makes her look, as Susan said, not like a candidate of the future, not like an avatar of the future, but like some kind of a relic from the 90s.
Right. But what was the purpose here, Daniel? Was she just trying to make sure there's no paper trail here of her actions?
Well, maybe it was a convenience, as she said 10 or 15 times during that press conference. I don't think the particular email thing is a scandal or particularly damaging. It's been the way she's handled it, and that's what's given all of us who have covered these campaigns before some kind of PTSD, seeing this is going on again. Lanny Davis is out defending her on television, and oh my, you know, that not only is the server private, but we've destroyed some of the emails, and it just feels like the Rose Law Firm all over again. And if you want to get rid of this, yeah, it's unfair, the scrutiny, but if you want to get rid of it, you've got to come clean and move on.
To be clear, I don't think Americans care about how we react to it, right? That right. It's not
but
nice
they may
for
react
us.
But they react, yeah.
Or remember the Rose Law Firm.
Yes,
for that matter.
But it does definitely have that feel.
But to Dana's point, though, it may not be a huge scandal, but there has never been another Secretary of State or a Secretary of any head of any other government that we any other government agency we know of that has done what she did. which was proactively at the very beginning decide I'm going to set up my own parallel information infrastructure in my house. And then after I leave office, I am going to be the sole judge and jury over what I'm going to release. And then I'm going to destroy everything else. I'm sorry, from the perspective of history, that just looks weird. It does not smell right. And it is unusual, to say the least.
And as President Obama said last night at the Gridiron Dinner, I didn't even know you could have your own server.
He said, I thought I was the candidate of the technological future. And here's Hillary way out ahead of me.
Well, we've talked about the Democrats. Hey, but we've got to talk a little bit about the Republicans here. To me, the most interesting story of the week was the disclosure that Marco Rubio and Mitt Romney have suddenly become new best buddies. Now, mind you, Marco Rubio, his mentor was Jeb Bush. I can remember when people said, look, if Jeb Bush decides to run, there's no way that Marco Rubio is going to get in the same race because Jeb Bush was his mentor all in those Florida politics. And yet now we see something entirely different. John, what do you make of that?
Well, first of all, there is a part of the Republican establishment that is that likes Jeb Bush fine, but does not want to sacrifice the mantle of the future. They think if Hillary Clinton's going to be the nominee, we do not want to have another Bush running against her. And so there is an openness to someone who is of a younger generation, whether that's Scott Walker or Marco Rubio or someone else. So Marco Rubio is going to get a look. And you'll remember that when Mitt Romney announced that he was not going to make a third run, one of the things he said explicitly was that it was time for a new generation. And people read that as an implicit shot at Jeb Bush. So the fact that the two of them are now new best friends, BFFs, as you say, doesn't surprise me that much. I think he was leading us towards his support or potential support for Rubio in that statement.
You know, what's kind of interesting about that, Romney said that after it became clear that Jeb Bush was getting most of his big donors.
Yes.
And they told Romney they were for him, and then suddenly they became supporters of
not a lot of love lost between Romney world and Bush world.
It's always shocking to find disloyalty in politics, but it's happened once again with Marco Rubio. Now, I think what you have happening here is Jeb Bush is in that position that Romney was before him and McCain was before him and George W. Bush was before him, and that is he's the likely guy. He's going to be everybody's second choice, but first they have to flirt with all the others. They're going to have their Scott Walker flirtation. They'll get for their Marco Rubio flirtation and all the others down the line when they realize we probably don't have a choice, and it's going to be Jeb Bush again.
Well, and why wouldn't Marco Rubio, by the way, take this chance?
Right.
Barack Obama proved that you don't have to be in the Senate for very long. You don't have to necessarily wait until you're wizened and spend 40 years in the trenches anymore. And in fact, sometimes you're better off not doing that because you have a cleaner record. You have less of a baggage to run. So it's a free shot for Marco Rubio. Why wouldn't he want to get out there and mix it up?
Also, you can very credibly see Marco Rubio. I realize he's running for president, but you can clearly see him as a potential vice presidential nominee on the Republican ticket. And at his age, he can afford to run for vice president and run for president down the road because he's a young man. He's Hispanic. And these are important assets in a Republican Party that's trying to look for a new direction.
Yeah.
Do you all think, though, at the end of the day, it's going to be Bush and Hillary Clinton? Because I've got to tell you, I think they're both overwhelming favorites right now, but I'm not convinced it's a done deal on either side.
I've been saying now for about 2 months that I cannot construct a rational argument for why it will not be Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, and yet deep in my gut somehow, I don't believe that somehow they will be the nominees. I can't explain it, but I just can't see
politics
it.
Politics is rarely a linear process, right?
Right? Especially when the Clintons are involved.
Right, from point A to point B, it's a simple boom, 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 boom. Things happen. Surprises happen. You would have had a hard time putting together a plausible argument just three, 4 years ago that Jeb Bush could have been a candidate even because of the fatigue with his brother and so forth. And yet here he is as the front runner. So I do think politics is
But it's hard even to see where the surprise will be. I spent some time with Martin O'Malley this week saying maybe he could be it. And it was just, you know, milquetoast O'Malley and, you know, talking about sewage treatment plants. And I'm thinking that's probably just not going to light the nation on fire.
I don't think it's going to be a Bush-Clinton race. I mean, I can't tell you what it is going to be, but it's too neat. We're too far out. We're always too wrong at this point to say what's going to happen. And while I think Hillary Clinton is definitely an overwhelming favorite for the Democratic nomination, only Hillary Clinton can cost her that, I think Bush is a fragile front runner when you talk about the Republican nomination.
He's a better retail candidate that people give him credit for, but between immigration, Common Core, and this sense of not another Bush, there's an opening there for some other Republican that somehow that alchemy will open the door to somebody else.
Wasn't
somebody
there a Clinton Rudy Giuliani race 8 years ago at the time?
Yes.
Right? Oh, yeah. We're all fairly sure, right?
Yeah.
What about Bibi Netanyahu? You know, it was such...
He probably will not run. Gave a good speech.
Well, but it was such a big deal when he came over and addressed the Congress, and now it seems to be kind of just swept away.
Well, it clearly didn't help him, and maybe it hurt him. But I think what needs to happen here is Tom Cotton needs to write a letter to the Israelis saying, we will not recognize the results there unless Netanyahu is returned to power.
No one would be more pleased in the White House if Bibi Netanyahu does not get another time as prime minister there.
And now here is the question, and I'm sure you'll be able to help. Where is Vladimir Putin?
Isn't that a great question? Know? Yeah. This is very unusual. Even in the old bad Soviet days when leaders died and it took them a while to make it public, it didn't last this long. So, look, he's probably not dead. Obviously, that's pretty hard to cover up. But he might be sick. He might not be presentable in that sense. He cultivates this macho, healthy image. If he had the flu, if he had some other stroke, some people have argued, perhaps, he would want to stay out of the public limelight for a little while. But this is something scary because this man is in such singular control of the only other country on the planet that could destroy us all that it's a pretty important moment. It's kind of funny, but it's also important.
Well, who knows? He may have come down with a flu, running around without his shirt and a hat. And, you know, he gets cold over there.
But hard to understand why they haven't had released a picture of him talking.
Shirtless or not.
Right. Yes, yeah, right.
Even an old one would be fine.
But they have, and they've misdated them, actually, to make it look like their current dates. They took old pictures and said this is dated more recently.
I think they need to do a new picture, to be clear. Yeah.
If you all find out where he is.
I thought I saw him at your table last night at the Gridiron, but that was not
him. Where he is, call me, okay? It'll be news. And thank you all so much. Well, that is all the time we have this week, so we want to thank you for watching and to tell you that we will see you next Sunday right here. I'm Bob Schieffer, and this has been Face the Nation. Today's guests were Secretary of State John Kerry, Senators Tom Cotton and Joe Manchin, Congressman Elijah Cummings, and NAACP President Cornell William Brooks. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. Senior producers are Rob Hinden and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne. Face the Nation originates in CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern every Sunday.